You are currently the only person in this conference.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, guys.
Start by saying that anybody in attendance who's not hearing me right now, please press 5 on your phone, and the excellent people over at InterOccupy will square you away. And now on behalf of everybody in attendance, let me say thank you very much, Professor, for taking the time to be with us today and for a long lifetime of impeccable scholarship and activism.
Oh, thanks a lot. Glad to be with you.
All right, Mikhail, if you'd be so kind, first question, please.
Absolutely. Professor Chomsky, how are you, sir? This is Mikhail Kamil.
Hi.
Beautiful. Professor Chomsky, the 99% are all students of yours, and we thank you for being one with us. The Occupy movement is in its second phase, and three of our main goals are to, one, occupy the mainstream and transition from the tents and into the hearts and minds of the masses. Two, hard block the repression of the movement by protecting the 99% freedom of assembly. And speak without being violently attacked. And three, in corporate personhood. These goals, these three goals, overlap and, of course, are interdependent. We're interested in learning what your position is on the mainstream filtering, the repression of civil liberties, and money in politics as it relates to Occupy and the future of America. Shalom, and thank you, sir.
Thank you. Well, the cover, I think the first question, I think, has to do with coverage of Occupy. It's been mixed. I mean, at first it was dismissive and, making fun of people playing games and silly kids and so on. But it changed. In fact, one of the really remarkable, almost spectacular successes of the Occupy movement is that it simply changed the entire framework of discussion of many issues. I mean, there were things that were sort of known, but kind of in the margins, hidden, which are now right up front, like the imagery of 99% and 1%, the dramatic facts of sharply rising inequality over the past roughly 30 years, with wealth being concentrated in a small fraction of 1% of the population has a very heavy impact on the ridiculous maldistribution of wealth, while for the majority, real incomes have pretty much stagnated or sometimes declined, benefits declined, work hours going up, and so on. Now, it's not third world misery, but it's not what it ought to be in a rich society, the richest in the world, in fact, with plenty of wealth around, which people can see, but just not in their pockets. And all of this has been brought to the fore. It's now almost a standard framework of discussion. Even the terminology is accepted. Well, that's a big shift. Meanwhile, the coverage of the Occupy movement itself has been varied. In some places, for example, parts of the business press, there's been a fairly sympathetic coverage occasionally. Of course, the general picture is, why don't they go home and let us get on with their work? Or where's their political program? Or how do they fit into the mainstream structure of how things are supposed to change and so on? And then came the inevitable repression, which, of course, is inevitable. It was pretty clearly coordinated around the country. Some of it was pretty brutal. Other places less so. And there's been a kind of a standoff. Some of the occupations have, in effect, been removed. Others have filtered back in some other form. The media coverage of that, I think, has occasionally... Some of the things have been covered, like the pepper spray and so on. But a lot of it is just considered, again, sort of, why don't they go away and leave us alone? Well, that's to be anticipated. The question of how to respond to it is the primary way to respond to it is one of the points that you made. Reaching out to bring into the general occupation in a kind of metaphorical sense, bring into it much wider sectors of the population. I mean, there's a lot of sympathy for the goals and aims of the Occupy movement, quite high in polls, in fact, but that's a big step short of engaging people in it. It has to become part of their lives, something they think they can do something about. So it's necessary to get out into communities, and that means not just with a message, but if possible, and this would be hard, to try to spread and deepen one of the real achievements of the movement, which I don't think does get discussed in the media, at least I haven't seen it. One of the main achievements has been to create communities, real functioning communities of mutual support, democratic interchange, care for one another, and so on. This is highly significant, especially in a society like ours, in which people are tend to be very isolated, neighborhoods have broken down, community structures have broken down, people are kind of alone. And there's an ideology which there's a lot of effort to implant. It's so inhuman that it's hard to get into people's heads. But the ideology of you just take care of yourself and forget about anyone else. Extreme version is the Ayn Rand version. Actually, there's been an effort for 150 years, literally, to try to impose that way of thinking on people. You go back to the origins of the Industrial Revolution in eastern Massachusetts in mid-19th century. There happened to be a very lively press run by working people, young women in the factories, artisans in the mills, and so on. They had their own press. It was very lively, very interesting, very widely read, a lot of support. And they were bitterly condemned the way the industrial system was taking away their freedom and liberty and imposing on them a kind of a rigid hierarchical structures that they didn't want. One of their main complaints was what they called the new spirit of the age, gain wealth, forgetting all but self. For 150 years, there's been massive efforts to try to impose the new spirit of the age on people. As I say, it's so inhuman that there's a lot of resistance. And it continues. And one of the real achievements of the Occupy movement, I think, has been to develop a real manifestation of rejection of this in a very striking way, where the people involved are not in it for themselves. They're in it for one another and for the broader society and for future generations. And there are bonds and associations that were formed that if they can persist and if they can be brought into the wider community, I think that would be the real defense against the inevitable repression with its sometimes violent manifestations.
Let me ask you to put a little meat on those bones. How best do you think the Occupy movement should go about engaging communities? What method should be employed there? And would you think it's prudent to actually have space and decentralized bases of operations within, at least in New York City, the five boroughs?
It would certainly make sense to have spaces, whether they should be open public spaces or not, and to what extent they should be is a kind of a tactical decision that has to be, the decisions have to be made on the cases of a close evaluation of the circumstances, the degree of support, the degree of opposition. Different for different places, and I don't know of any general statement. About the methods, people have problems and concerns, and if they can be helped to feel that these problems and concerns are part of a broader movement of people who support them and who they support, well, then it can take off. And there's no simple way of doing it, single way of doing it. There's no answer. You might go into a neighborhood and find that their concerns are how to have something maybe as simple as a traffic light on the street where kids cross to go to school, or maybe have prevent people from being tossed out of their homes on foreclosures, or try to develop community-based enterprises. Not at all inconceivable. Enterprises owned and managed by the workforce, and the community, which can then overcome the choice of some remote multinational and board of directors made out of banks to shift production somewhere else. These are real, very live issues happening all the time, and it can be done. Actually, a lot of it is being done in scattered ways, and a whole range of other things, depending on police brutality, civic corruption, the reconstruction of media that come right out of the communities is perfectly possible. They didn't have some genetic difference in the mid-19th century that enabled people to have a live media system of a community-based, sometimes ethnic-based, labor-based, many other groupings. All of that can be reconstructed. I mean, it takes work, and it can bring people together doing these things together. Actually, I've seen things done in various places, which are models that could be followed. I'll just give you one example. I happened to be in Brazil a couple of years ago, and I was spending some time with Lula, the former president. This is actually before he was elected president. He was a labor activist, an activist, and so on. We traveled around some together. One day he took me out to a suburb of Rio. The suburbs in Brazil, and like in most places, are where the poor people live. The rich people live downtown. So the suburbs are the big poor areas, very, they don't have very much, millions of people. We went out there, we took me out one evening when they were having it's semi-tropical, so people are outside a lot, and this big public square. Well, what was happening was that a small company, a small group of professionals, media professionals from the town, came out regularly, put up a truck in the middle of the square. This is 9 o'clock at night, prime TV time. But a lot of people are milling about. They put up a truck. They had a screen above it. And on the screen, they presented skits, plays, written by people in the community, acted by people in the community. They were on pretty serious. Some of them were kind of, just for fun. Others were quite serious about debt, about AIDS, about quite serious matters. As I say, written by and acted by local people, mostly pretty young people. And as people gathered around in the square, some of the actors, of course, everyone knows each other. Some of the actors walked around with mics, asking people to comment on the material that had been presented. They were filmed commenting on it, so that was shown on the screen. Other people could see it. Other people reacted. Maybe somebody sitting in a small bar nearby, or walking around the streets. And in no time, you had a quite interesting interchanges and discussions among people about quite serious topics that are part of their lives. Well, if it can be done in a poor area, in a Brazilian slum, that we can certainly do it in better ways in many places. But I think these are the kinds of, I'm not suggesting you duplicate exactly that, but these are the kinds of things that it can be done to engage broader sectors and help them, give them a reason to feel that they can be part of this too. And if that extends substantially enough with the formation of communities and the development of very of serious programs adapted to whatever people's needs happen to be, could be anything from very simple things up to starting to create a new socioeconomic system with worker and community-owned enterprises. A whole range of things are possible, and I don't think there's any particular formula as to how you go about doing it ever, any more than there was, has been in any other popular movement. But with a little imagination and initiative and engagement, I think many such possibilities are opened up. And that's the best means of defense. The more active public support there is, the better defense there is against repression and violence.
Okay. I want to come back, bring back Mikhail, the third facet of Mikhail's questions regarding getting money out of politics. How would you go about dealing with such a daunting task? And can you see that happening as an extension of the community involvement and engagement that you were just talking about?
Well, getting money out of politics is a very crucial matter. It has been for a long time. It's gotten much more extreme now. I mean, it's now at the point where elections for a long time have just been public relations extravaganzas where people are kind of mobilized to get excited every 4 years and push a button and go home and forget about it. There's a lot of ways to go about overcoming that. Some of them reach as far as organizing for constitutional conventions. Let's say to take away a corporate personhood. That's far-reaching. We're not anywhere near that. But there are much more short-term things that are possible. Like we happen to be in the primary system, a primary period right now. Well, the way primaries are carried out in the United States, and this is just taken for granted, is radically undemocratic. What happens is, say New Hampshire primary, first one, candidates show up, come to a town, a lot of publicity, a lot of ads and so on, a lot of hoopla. Maybe they rent a hall or something. And then they tell the people in the town, here's who I am, here's what I'm going to do. And, of course, they never say anything much. Vote for me. And if they do say anything, nobody has a reason to believe them. It's possible to imagine a Democratic primary. I don't mean the Democratic Party. I mean done democratically. How would it be done in a functioning democracy? Well, the people in the town would get together, have town meetings, discussions, and come up with some ideas about what they think ought to be done in the locality, in the country, foreign policy, the whole range. And then they would say, well, if you want to come and you tell the candidate, but first of all, they might just pick their own candidates. Or if there are national candidates running, they could say, you can come to visit us if you like, but we don't want to hear speeches from you. We're going to tell you what we think policy ought to be. And if you can convince us that you'll accept these policies and carry them forward, then maybe we'll vote for you. I mean, either that or direct representation coming out of the communities would be a democratic alternative to the kind of farcical system that we simply take for granted. Well, these are ways of, right from the ground, and there are many other possibilities of getting money out of politics. There are broader ways which involve legislation and so on. And those these things are not in conflict with one another. There's a lot of ways of going about the same ends. And it's a very critical part. You don't really have – it's not just elections. I mean, things have reached a point in the United States where even within Congress, if someone wants a position of a degree of power and authority, they literally have to buy it. It used to be that chair of a committee, say, was granted by the parties on the basis of seniority, service, and other factors. Now you literally have to pay the party to be a candidate for a chair. Well, that has an effect, too. It drives the members of Congress also into the same corporate pockets, just if they want to get anywhere. Again, this is not 100%, but these are pretty widespread tendencies, and they're tending to fragment, to shred whatever's left of functioning democracy. You can see it in the campaigns, which are just farcical.
Absolutely. Let me ask you, considering that the movement began with a relatively large dose of anarchist inspiration, how do you think we can best recapture the meaning of that term in society and dispel all the various stereotypes that exist?
Well, to dispel the stereotypes, you have to be doing something concrete and constructive that people can identify with. What I mentioned before, the development of kind of spontaneous development of communities of mutual support and democratic participation, that's something that people can comprehend and can consider to be of value for themselves, which they can maybe develop in some other way in their own communities. That's the only way to get rid of stereotypes and also even to develop your own conceptions, our own conceptions of what a meaningful kind of true system of liberty and freedom and a mutual aid would be like. You learn these things by doing them, and others will be brought in to the extent that they see something valuable in it.
All right. We're now, as everybody knows, we're coming into an election season, and the movement to date has been dependent on external sources of funding and to various degrees. By the election, the party's prop, mainly the Democratic Party, lurking in the background. How do you assess the goals of the Democratic Party as far as co-opting the movement, and what should we be vigilant in looking at? As much.
Well, each of the two parties, such as they are, actually I should say the Republicans have, even many years ago, have abandoned much of a pretense of being a traditional political party. They are so uniformly and with such dedication committed to tiny sectors of power and profit that they're hardly a political party anymore. And they have to have a catechism, they have to repeat in lockstep unity, kind of like a caricature of the old Communist Party. They have to do something to get a voting constituency, because you can't get that from the 1%, the huge industry. So they've been mobilizing sectors of the population that were always there, but not particularly politically organized very well. Religious evangelicals, nativists who are terrified that their country's being taken away from, their rights are being taken away, a lot of small businesses involved. I mean, I hate to say it, but if you look at it historically, it's not unlike the demography that was organized by the Nazis and the big industrialists who supported them. Didn't turn out very pretty, and they're kind of stuck on that. It's almost a necessary step once they've abandoned any pretense of working for the interests of the population. The Democrats are a little bit different. They have different constituencies. They're following along pretty much the same path. So the centrist Democrats of today, the ones who essentially run the party, they're pretty much the moderate Republicans of a generation ago. They've been kicked out of the Republican Party. They now are kind of the mainstream of the Democrats. And they're going to try to organize and to mobilize, co-opt, if you like, their constituency. That's the Democrats, interestingly, have pretty much abandoned the white working class. It's rather striking to see. So that's barely part of their constituency at this point, which is a pretty sad development. But they will try to mobilize elements of the Hispanics, blacks, what are called progressives of various kinds. They'll try to reach out to the Occupy movements. The organized labor is still part of the Democratic constituency. They try to co-opt them. And with Occupy, it's just the same as all the others. The political leadership will try to say, pat you on the head and say, yeah, I'm for you, vote for me. And the people involved have to understand that maybe they'll do something for you, but only if you maintain substantial pressure. You can get elected leadership to do things, but they're not going to do it on their own, with very rare exceptions. They're subject to other pressures. As far as money in politics is concerned, it's hard to beat the comment of the great political financier Mark Hanna about a century ago. He was asked what was important in politics. He said there are three things important in politics. The first is money. The second is money. And I've forgotten what the third one is. That was a century ago. It's by now much more extreme. So yes, a concentrated wealth will of course try to use its wealth and power to take over the political system as much as possible, to run it, to make sure it does what they want, etc. It'd be kind of like a miracle if they didn't. The public has to find ways to struggle against that. And it can. Centuries ago, political theorists like David Hume, famous, one of his foundations of the foundations of government, pointed out correctly that power is in the hands of the governed, those who are governed, not the governors. And that's true whether it's a feudal society or a military state or, nothing much in the way of a functioning parliamentary democracy at the time he wrote, but there too. Power is in the hands of the governed. The only way the rulers can overcome that is by control of opinion and control of attitudes. We're now mid-18th century. And he was right, and it remains true. The power is in the hands of the general population. There are massive efforts to control it, less by force today than there used to be, because a lot of rights have been won, which makes force less efficacious. So by other means, propaganda, consumerism, stirring up ethnic hatreds and so on, all kinds of ways. Sure, that's always going to go on and have to find ways to resist it. Same with being co-opted. I mean, there's nothing wrong with supporting, giving tentative support to a particular candidate as long as that person's doing what you want. But it's not, it would be a more democratic society if representatives were also recallable, without huge effort. Well, they're not, but there are other ways of pressuring candidates to do things, and many would do it willingly. It's a fine line between doing that and being co-opted, mobilized to serve someone else's interests. But those are just constant decisions and choices that have to be made.
I want to be mindful of the clock
And if you have to run, please let me know.
I will, when my boss comes in here and tells me the next appointment's coming.
Okay, beautiful. Let me ask you real quickly, could you speak a little bit about Antonio Gramsci, about how his ideas relate to the things you've been talking about?
I like Gramsci. He's an important person, but he talked about he talked about things not unlike what David Hume was saying, how a cultural hegemony is established by systems of power. I personally think that it's worth reading, but at least when I read it, it simply says well what we more or less know, I think. I don't find anything very novel, or maybe my inadequacy. You read it and see what you think.
Okay. All right. Relatively quickly, great deal of our economics is dominated by ideas of growth and an incredible fixation, constant growth, more and more and more. How do you assess our reliance economically on the constant expansion and those expectations broadly within the society?
Well, we are. I mean, the whole human species at the moment is facing a very serious problem of whether even decent existence can be carried forward. We're kind of coming close to the edge of a precipice on environmental destruction. Now, if growth is understood to mean constant, to carry with it constant attacks on the physical environment that sustains life, like, for example, greenhouse emissions or destruction of agricultural land or so on and so forth. If that's what it means, we are like lemmings walking over a cliff. But that isn't what growth has to mean. For example, growth might mean simpler lives in more livable communities. That takes work. It doesn't just come by itself. It takes labor. It takes a development, but of a different kind, oriented towards different goals than simply having more consumer goods in your pocket. And I think functioning free communities like the Occupy communities can be working towards and developing for themselves and spreading to others is just a different way of living, which is not based on maximizing consumer goods, but in maximizing values that are important for life. That's growth too, just growth in a different direction.
All right, our present crisis, the most recent one, namely the real estate bubble. Can you talk about that, how we got to this point in terms of historical context and why you think it occurred and what is really at the root of its occurrence?
Well, at the root of its occurrence is the major shift in the economy that began to take place in the 70s, really escalated radically under Reagan, Thatcher in England, and then on from there. If you go back, there was a big growth period in the United States, the greatest growth in history. It's the 50s and the 60s. And at that time, it was also egalitarian. So the lowest sector, the lowest quintile did about as well as the upper quintile. And it absorbed into the mainstream society groups that had been excluded. African Americans, for example, had been pretty much excluded for centuries, literally. So some of them could get integrated into society. That came to an end at the end of the 60s. In the 70s, starting in the mid-70s, there was a very substantial shift. For one thing, there was a shift towards increasing the role of finance in the society. Finance is Now, one of the great financial economists just wrote recently that the financial systems are wiping out functioning markets the way a larva eats away at its host and destroys it. He's one of the most respected financial economists in the world, incidentally, not a radical. That's what the effect of the financial systems has been. Now, also combined with this was corporate decisions to shift production abroad. It's not a law of nature, again. You can have decent working conditions and production at home, but they made more profit that way. These decisions greatly changed the economy. And that's
I didn't understand your question. What was that?
Did you ask me?
No, go right ahead. No, Mom. I'm sorry
about
that. Checking. Yeah, I'll have to. I just got my notice that I'm off. But let me just go back to your last question about the housing bubble, which I'm sort of building up to slightly. It's too slowly. Anyway, one effect of this was that as wealth became extremely concentrated heavily in financial industries, and that led to concentration of political power, leads to legislation, so on and so forth, which keeps the vicious cycle going. And part of that was deregulation. During the 50s and the 60s, the great growth period, banks were regulated. There were no crises. No major bubbles at first. Starting in the 80s, you started getting financial crises, bubbles. There were several during the Reagan administration. The Clinton administration ended with a huge tech bubble that burst. There's a lot of money floating around, and much less real production of what people need. And one of the ways in which households were able to survive during the period of stagnation was just by getting caught up in bubbles. Early in this century, the housing prices started to shoot up way beyond the trend. There is a kind of a trend line of about a century. Housing prices kind of roughly matched to gross domestic product. About 10 years ago, they just started shooting way out of sight. No fundamentals. A lot of it was essentially robbery. The prime, subprime mortgages, slicing up complicated devices by which the banks could slice up the mortgage so that others would be have the responsibility when it collapsed, complicated derivatives, other financial instruments. All of this took off, created a huge bubble. It was obviously going to burst. It was barely even noticed by almost the entire economics profession, including the Federal Reserve. The minutes of the 2006 Federal Reserve meetings just came out recently. You may have seen them. And rather strikingly, there was no recognition there that there's a multi-trillion dollar housing bubble that has no basis whatsoever and is going to collapse. In fact, they were congratulating themselves on how marvelously they're running the economy. Well, of course, it collapsed as it had to. Maybe $8 trillion of paper wealth lost. For much of the population, that's all they had. Like for African Americans, the net worth, what you actually own, is what you actually have, the capital you have, that's reduced to practically nothing. And for many others, too. So, of course, it's a disaster. And that kind of thing is going to happen as long as you have unregulated capital markets, which furthermore have a government insurance policy. Credit agencies already, when they rate a company, say Goldman Sachs, they take into account the fact that it's going to be rescued by the taxpayer next time it goes bust. Well, that, of course, increases risk even further. And if it won't be housing, it'll be something else, commodities or whatever. It's a financial casino instead of a productive economy. And, of course, The people who get hurt are not the rich and powerful, the 99%. I'm afraid I've got to leave. Somebody else waiting.
Well, on behalf of all of us, thank you again. We love you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Take care. All right, ladies and gentlemen, fine people at InterOccupy, you're going to open this bad boy up the stack. So InterOccupy, have at it.
Hey, everybody, this is Misha from Occupy Toronto. So there was a lot of great stuff there, and I want to thank Miguel and Ian so much for pulling this together, this interview with Noam. And what we were thinking was if folks have time to stay on the call and want to discuss more about what Noam has been talking about, that we would open up a stack to do that. So going over the stack again, or the numbers on your dial pad, you press 1, that's to get on stack. Number 2 is to show agreement, applause, or approval for the current speaker. That's kind of like wiggly fingers in the GA. Number 3 is disagreement with the current speaker's comments. Number 4 is if you have a direct response to the current speaker. And number 5, again, is if you need tech assistance or have a point of order. So with that, you can just open it up. We've got a couple of number 1s there. So William, go ahead. Your mic is live.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It was an absolute pleasure listening to Professor Chomsky and his copious amount of experience and knowledge. My main question, I believe he really did hit it on the head when we asked how do we get society and the community and the economy in solidarity with the movement and further remove the stigma attached to us as wackadoos from the right wing when he said do something positive and concrete so that people can identify with it. That's something that's just always been true, and I feel like if we just harness our frustration and our energy and focus it back on restoration and not fixing something that was never broken, we'll be able to eliminate every division within our own movement and incorporate everyone into it, because we all deserve accessibility. At the end of the day, we're all farmers. All of our grandparents were farmers, no matter what race or culture you come from. At the end of the day, we're all family. We're all one body. And seeing that the South Central Farm in modern history is the largest urban farm in the United States of America, and seeing that the farm's history of existence has always been revolved around race and riots, the question remains, how can we reopen this peacefully? The Rodney King anniversary, 21st anniversary, is approaching March 3rd, 2012, and my question is, how can we gain accessibility today to buy this Los Angeles South Central farm back in a peaceful, but in a celebratory manner?
That's great. Thanks so much, William. I want to remind folks that there's a minute and 30 seconds, 90 seconds time limit, and when you hear that bell go off, that just means you've got 30 seconds left. So I'll go ahead and take the next hand there. Steve, did you have your hand up?
Yes, I did. You know, Noam is obviously a brilliant fellow, but there's one thing that I think he missed. I was working in the banking industry on Wall Street at one point, and they knew exactly what was going on. But in 1998 and 99, the Federal Trade Commission testified before both houses, finance committees and Congress, as well as the Federal Trade Commission, on 3 different occasions, explaining the huge bubble, and the problem subprime mortgages were causing in California. But Alan Greenspan was an Ayn Rand economist. He felt governments should stay out of the business, and markets would regulate themselves and correct themselves. The problem is that correction might be a 30-year cycle. In the meantime, our nation finds itself in the situation it is now. There were many who knew these mortgages were bad as heck, but they just let them go because fees were so strong. I yield.
Okay, thanks so much, Steve. So the next hand that we have up here is Julia Clark. Go ahead, Julia.
Hello. Thank you for taking my mic. I would like to definitely point out in the situation of the markets, of the farms, of the USDA, the NOP, the very many various agencies, is the addressing of corruption. One of the largest ways corruption harms is when people look the other way and do not address what is verily in front of them. The system, to some extent, may be broken. There is large amounts of money pouring in to systems that's just not working for the people, not only for the people, but for the noble people of wealth. And it's a very difficult thing to address, but one of the simplest ways that can begin to address this is looking and helping folks that are trying to address the corruption in their smaller communities and help them help us. I yield.
Thanks so much, Julia. There's so many interesting things here, and you're getting a lot of number twos going up there, so there's a lot of people who agree with you. Again, number one to get on stack, that's number two for agreement, number three for disagreement, number four is direct response, and number five is a point of order or for tech assistance. And if we do see that there's a lot of number twos going up for a specific topic, we could maybe look at doing a breakout or something. So I'll go to the next speaker. Bentley, your mic is live. Go ahead, Bentley.
Yeah, thank you. I actually just wanted to use this time to talk about a national call that's for February 29th. Here, I'm with Occupy Richmond, and we are targeting the corporate media structure, which we have a lot of...
So we're going to try and use this time as much as possible to respond to what is really happening, and that call in particular. Now, I'm not sure exactly what happened there. Your mic went quiet, but it seems like a great opportunity to remind everybody to try and respond directly to what we're talking about here and try and stay on topic. So the next person then that we have here is Josh. Go ahead, Josh.
Is my mic live?
It is indeed.
Awesome. So I just want to readdress something that Noam brought up that we strongly agree with here in Richmond. I'm actually from Richmond as well, and that is the sense of community and how important that is going to be into furthering all of our agendas and all of our actions as Occupy. And we have a sort of a plan here in Richmond that we're following where we go into the communities and sort of try to hold neighborhood GAs, which I think is similar to what they were discussing in terms of the five boroughs in New York, where you go in for a couple weeks, you know, maybe do some canvassing, and then you try to hold a GA and spread that information. And while you're there canvassing, maybe start a community garden or have a canned food drive just for that particular community. And we're calling it a listening campaign because we're very interested in going out and hearing what these particular issues are. Because what that does is it builds trust and support and the mutual understanding, which is going to be so, so important when the corporations own the media. And Alexander Hamilton was very adamant when he said the power of the press is going to be what gets anyone elected. So also parallel to what Noam was saying in regards to the power of opinion and the power of the governed rather than the government, you know, we can really start to have a sway over public opinion and begin to combat media consolidation by building these relationships, building these community empathies with the surrounding brothers and sisters in an effort to once the massive revolution really, really starts, we'll be a little bit more prepared and we'll have more people to have our backs. I yield.
Alva, do you have a direct response to that?
Yes, I do. I actually submitted that on when I register, And I said that I really love the idea of going to the community for GA, because I think that in my previous revolution, the mainstream media is side, whether on the side of the public, whether the protesters. It is very important that we deliver our message public directly from us, because the goal of the main media is not in the best interest of or the public, or the goal is for their profit, how they can maximize their agenda. And the way to do it is to steer more negative comments, and more negative comments, then they get more publication. And they have to
continue it. Thanks so much, Alva. The next person that I have here is Joan. And remember, number one is...
Hello, thank you for everything you do. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Joan.
Go ahead, Joan.
Getting a lot of... yeah, you can hear me okay? Okay. I just wanted to say thanks to everyone at InterOccupy. I think you guys did a really nice job with this call, as the rest of them as well. But I did wanted to raise an issue that, you know, one of the things that we do as part of Occupy are these GAs, and we're trying to build a horizontal kind of network of people that feel that they have a platform to launch their ideas and their actions from. And so one of the things that I saw that was in tension in the presentation today was sort of this idea that we should move towards representative democracy. And what that means for someone like myself is difficult to answer, because I don't vote. I don't believe in voting. I think it's stupid, because there has never been a candidate that represents my own interests. And as someone who is... you know, an advocate for minority rights, you know, there are other avenues that we can pursue in terms of democracy and representation, that we as a movement should look towards creating these new models of government that will then be more inclusive to people's forms of life and how they choose to, you know, live their life. So it's more of a lifestyle politics comment and an idea that we should move away from this idea of representation, because it's starting to hurt the movement, and move towards articulating what we mean by horizontalism. I yield.
Thanks so much, Joan. William, did you have a direct response to that?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I love the reoccurring theme of doing something positive and concrete so that people can identify with it, so they can feel a sense of community, so they can learn that this really is about family, and this isn't about ego, this isn't about some sort of movement, but just restoration. It's no secret that Los Angeles is the homeless capital of the nation, and it is as well the homeless capital of the world. And to me, there's no better time than now. I first heard about The Farm in December 2010 when I saw the Oscar-nominated documentary on Netflix called The Garden, after I was working for a bunk nonprofit that's a registered 501c3. We were raising $2 million a year and over $46,000 a month in canvassing in Westwood. So. That was my main point, and thank you very, very much for sharing that, because I love focusing on that.
That's great. Thank you so much, William. Ian, you're next. Go ahead. Your mic is live.
Hello, all. I just wanted to say the incredible grin on my face just interacting with and hearing from occupiers all over the country that otherwise I would never ever hear from. Thank you, InterOccupy. I wanted to echo what the gentleman from Richmond was saying as far as having a listening tour, and go one step further and advocate along the lines, I don't know necessarily whether Professor Chomsky was saying it explicitly, but matter of fact, I won't put my words in his mouth, but what I think we need to have is a sustained presence in communities. I mean, I live in a community that's afflicted with everything under the sun, so I wouldn't even have to travel far. But I think ultimately Occupy needs to have a space that can't be wiped off the board with the backhand of a mayor that doesn't like what they're doing, what we're doing, because I think they're not going to like what we're doing if we're doing it correctly. And stemming from that listening, stemming from that sustained presence, we need to ultimately be responsive in a very concrete way and help to ameliorate the problems that these communities and our communities are being afflicted by. And that, I think, is the best way to go about sustaining this movement. And I will yield.
Okay, thank you so much, Ian. So the next person that I've got here is Giovanni. Go ahead, Giovanni, your mic's live.
Hey, thanks so much. I'm from Occupy El Paso, and I just wanted to say, in terms of what Noam was speaking of, in regards to engaging, I know for us who were predominantly Latino in El Paso, located along the border, that as much as we wanted to protest in front of the big banks and raise issues around that, it was central for us to get involved with the farm workers' struggle to really engage the most marginalized communities in our community to really create the reconciliation of what a community could look like. And that's it, really. And that engaging communities of all sorts is, I think, the next step forward. I yield. Thank you.
Thanks, Giovanni. And I think that's really great if you can say which Occupy you're from at the start. Just helps people get a sense of who's on the call. John De Herrera. I apologize for the name pronunciation, but your mic is live.
No problem. John D. Herrera, Occupy Santa Barbara. There was one point in the call where we talked about, we asked Noam, how do we remove private funds from public elections? I mean, that's really kind of the foundation, of, I think, of what a lot of Occupy is about, is how do we remove that private money from elections? And the first thing he said was the idea of a constitutional convention. And he somehow linked that with the idea of removing corporate personhood. But we could have an Article 5 convention to propose an amendment that removes private funds from public elections. It's a very solid idea that's nonpartisan. And Mr. Chomsky intimated that that's a long way off, that a convention is a long way off, and but actually that's really not true, because right now, for instance, ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, they are pushing for a balanced budget amendment, and they have a pamphlet out to conservative legislators about how to propose or how to cast an application to Congress for a convention. So I think InterOccupy, if we put the word out to the Occupies, look, we need an Article 5 convention because we're not going to get the amendment that we need, and legislation is not going to come through the Congress that we have. So we need a convention. On Monday night's call, we talk about that, but on Thursday night, there's an InterOccupy call for the Article 5 convention. Thanks, everyone, and I yield.
Okay, thank you so much. Now, Travis, did you have a direct response to that? Oh, sorry. There you are. Travis?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was just saying I can't agree more. I think it should just be the primary focus of the whole movement is just to get money out of politics, get some publicly funded campaigns being the primary way in which we do things. One of my main things that he was iterating was that it's bipartisan, so we should really focus on not the differences that the significant differences that exist between us and, say, the Tea Party, who has been well mobilized and has political connections and whatnot. We should work with them because they do have the numbers, they do have the religious vote in there too. And possibly that could put the pressure that we need on Congress to get this, or the legislators to get this convention going and get an amendment in the Constitution for that. And I think that that is the primary problem of all, the primary reason behind all problems, really, in the world. So, you know, you could pretty much stem it all back to that. So I yield.
Thank you so much, Travis. And, you know, I'm seeing an explosive number of twos coming up here. So I'm going to put all the hands down for a second and see if there's people who want to break out on this topic. So that would mean it would be an opportunity to just go into a specific room to discuss this. The rest of the call would still go on. But go ahead and press two now if you'd be interested in doing an actual breakout on this right now. So that's two if you want to do a breakout on that, or we can continue. This room will continue, of course. And so I'll just wait a couple of seconds. Maybe I'll take the next ones while we're doing that, and then after this next person, then I'll put you guys into a breakout room there. Okay, Walt, you're next. Go ahead, Walt.
Hi, Walt Roberts, Portland, Oregon, and part of the InterOccupy crew. I was struck by Noam's advice for occupiers to get involved in doing something that's visible and helpful and valuable to the community. And I think about movement building and about the health of the Occupy movement. And I do think that aspect of community building, our own social norms within this new culture that's arising, and community building in terms of doing things that help people see us reaching out and connecting in real ways. And I was also struck by another key element about the discourse and about the control of communication, you know, public discourse basically. And so I think that our message has come out and needs to continue to come out in a refined way. And the challenge about how to focus that message is in front of us still. And then finally, the various things that we're doing with actions and initiatives to bring pressure, to have reform or expose something, having those things happening in a strategic and coordinated way, when you put community building and that
guys,
communication.
You're now in a private breakout room on open mic to discuss the topic. Of getting money out of politics, as you wanted to. Somebody can just throw up a number five if you want me to dissolve the breakout room. Clear?
Yeah, you're actually on a public mic now. I think everybody can hear you. All right. Anyway, just to wrap up, I loved his talk, and I loved how he pointed to some basic specific things that talk to the broader strategic elements of what the movement is, naturally it's emerging, and we need to keep focusing on doing a better job of community building and controlling the airwaves and our ongoing campaign that has impact. I yield.
What we have here is Lauren Steiner. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yes, I love all the... I'm echoing. Well, I'll try to talk over my echoing. I love all the community building ideas, and we had a call yesterday. The Food Justice / May 1st Action call was talking about, you know, trying to expand what Philadelphia is doing, which is taking over vacant lots and planting community gardens. So we're going to be talking more about that. Also, I believe there's an alternative economy / intentional communities call that came out of a breakout group I was on at one point. I don't know if they're still having a regular call, but I think that's really great. But I think we have to address this issue of the violence, or what's being called the diversity of tactics, because I know a lot of people are leaving the movement. I watched the Oakland thing. I know that a lot of it was started by the police. And yes, the police should not be using public resources to...
Hey, you have a number five up. Did you want to get back into the main room?
Me? Hello?
Yep.
You're asking me if I want to get back in the main room? I thought I was in the main room.
But it was working.
Hello?
I just took you to another one, but I can put you back in that one if you want. Yep.
Yeah, I wanted to make this comment to the main room. This has nothing to do with getting money out of politics. Hello? Hello.
Thanks so much, Lauren.
But I didn't finish.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't finish because you were talking over me.
I apologize. I'm learning all the ins and outs of it. Sorry. Go.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that, you know, there was a group of people in Oakland that were determined to, you know, take this to another level. And, you know, in Occupy Seattle, there's a group that they had an article on their website about decolonizing, radicalizing the move, the radicalization of decolonize / Occupy Seattle, in which they really are taking this to a complete anti-capitalism movement. And I recognize that, you know, we have to be horizontal and that there's a lot of groups that feel this way, but if this takes over the Occupy movement, we are never going to grow our movement, and in fact, we are going to lose people that are currently in our movement. And I really think that Inner Occupy should schedule an emergency call about this, because I think it's really crucial and very antithetical to what, you know, Noam Chomsky was talking about. I yield.
Okay, thanks so much, Lauren. And it seems like there are a number of people who agree with you on that. So I'm going to ask if folks could put up a number two, if that is something that they would like to discuss, what Lauren was just talking about. So go ahead and put up a two now, and then we'll try and create a breakout room if it seems like there's an interest. So, Summer, you were next on the speakers list. Go ahead.
Okay. So, Summer here from Occupy Santa Cruz, Occupy Cabrillo, and MikeCheck.us, which is an online hub for the Occupy movement. My own personal story that relates to Noam's comment that we who are governed are the ones who ultimately have the power is that I recently became a student senator, and upon getting in this position, I felt the power that comes from such a position, as we have over $300,000 per semester that we as student senators get to allocate to whatever we decide we want that money to go to. Of course, public comments can come in, and people can request money, and we say yes or no, but ultimately we do have the power. Ultimately the constituents have the power if enough people speak up. So my idea with that, to go along with Mom, is to create like a door-to-door outreach from us to our constituents to literally give them their representatives' phone numbers and let them know, hey, if you have anything you ever want, anything you want changed, you have to call your representatives and let them know, because that is what democracy is about, letting our representatives know. If we're not calling them, if we wait every 4 years to just push a button and we don't do anything between those 4 years, we're going to listen to wherever the money is coming from. It's pretty simple. And in the same vein with occupying the media, our media outlets are in the same vein. They're just going to listen to whatever people are telling them to do, including the money people, unless we as people start speaking up and writing our letters to our media outlets and letting them know what we want as people. And one other thing was being electives, as Noam said. I agree with that. And I love the idea of taking over community lots and making gardens. I yield. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks so much. So next we have Rise, I believe. Oh, sorry, before we do that, actually, we need to get another note taker because Andrea has to take off. And thank you, Andrea, so, so much for all your hard work with this and with all of InterOccupy. But I'm going to put these fives down for a moment and just ask if there's somebody who could put up a five if they'd be willing to taking notes for the rest of the call. I'll just leave a second for that. That's great. Okay, Summer. I'm going to see if Steve is available to get you hooked up on that document. Thanks so much. So Rise, you're next. Your mic's live. Go ahead.
Mic check. Can you hear me?
Can indeed. Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay. A couple of things I want to actually, there's a whole bunch of things, so I'm going to do as quick as I can. The things that Noam was talking about, doing things that are positive, I think they're going to be a reflection, that, you know, there's a lot of things that are, can be considered positive, but they need to be aligned with the new set of values that we want to get to. The problem we've got now is not a group of individuals that are evil. What we've got is a systemic problem in the system where the wrong set of values are getting rewarded. And that needs to be looked at very clearly. The other thing, when he talked about the real estate bubbles and stuff like that, I know a lot of people I've talked to that have been burnt in the system. And, you know, people argue about what should real estate be. And I just wanted to offer a litmus test for what the value of real estate should be anywhere. And it's a very simple thing. And it's the people that work in town can live in town. And that creates, alleviates and takes a lot of pressure off so much of our environmental structure. It's got a 7-8 levels of knock-on effect that would alleviate a lot of pressure and pain for many, many people. The other thing is about a combination of who has power, the people that are governing or the people that govern. And, the people that are being governed definitely have the power because they're the masses. What happens is there's huge campaigns that have been going on for hundreds of years that chill people's rights, that threaten them, that intimidate them. That's constantly going on right now. And the power brokers or the puppet masters know exactly how that's done, and they use laws and techniques to do things like we just saw in Oakland and have happened all over the country. In fact, that matter, all over the world. And it's all done in covert ways. And so we've got to be aware of that. And I think a lot of people really understand how corrupt and bought the current system is. It's a systemic illness. And it's just beyond comprehension. You can just look at, there's great documentaries out there. There's one that's just come out, The Invisible War. Talks about stuff inside the military. There's one called Kill the Messenger by Sybil Edmonds. It comes from the Whistleblowers Association. It just goes to show you how screwed up we are. And we have to be aware of that so that we can make sure we ground it out. Not that we have to fight it, but we have to ground it out and then hold those people accountable for it. The other thing is, I think somebody mentioned this a little bit earlier about this notion of that we're kind of moving away from creating a new social economic structure to trying to work with this one. And I think there's a bunch of people I know of that have kind of backed away because they don't believe the current system can be resurrected or fixed or band-aided. It's just completely screwed up. So we've got to be aware
so
that
much.
We've got
thank
losing
you so much,
people.
Ryan. We got to leave some time on the mic for other people, but thank you so much for those comments. It's really valuable. I've got next up here is John DeHara again. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just thought that, again, the breakout session was a bad idea, but we had everyone listening all at once to everyone, and then suddenly we did a breakout session, and now we're cut off from the main group and stuff. I don't even know why that was suggested. In my opinion, it was it's the wrong move for this kind of call. But since we are here now talking about it, how are we going to remove money from politics? There's only one thing that can do that, and that is an amendment to the Constitution. If you think the Congress is going to propose legislation and pass it that removes private funds from elections, then there's something wrong with your critical thinking skills. It's not going to happen. We all know that. So we need an amendment. Congress is not going to propose it. There are conservatives right now already talking about trying to have a convention for a balanced budget amendment. Whatever is proposed, whether it's a balanced budget amendment or an amendment that removes private funds from elections, whatever it is, it's got to get 38 states to agree to it. That process of people lobbying their state legislators on which amendment they want ratified, that's our direct democracy again that we want. And that part of the puzzle can't happen unless we force Congress to issue the call. The way to force Congress to issue the call is simply to get a tipping point saying, yes, I would like to see a convention in my country during my lifetime. As soon as we get that tipping point,
Congress will make up, they will manufacture some narrative, and they will call a convention, and the Constitution will take care of us. So Thursday night is the Article 5 call. If you want to talk about meaningful change, you would be talking about the Article 5 convention, because anything short of that is going to get us what we've got for the last 50 years. I yield.
Thanks so much, John. And we are taking that into account. Now, there was a direct response there from William. Go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely relate to John's sentiments and his frustration. Private funding for public elections should have never been done. Obviously, we have to do everything in our power to get out of that. But screaming at the top of the mountain for the rich to stop being rich or the greedy to stop being greedy has never been proven throughout history to ever have worked. And I completely, wholeheartedly agree. But I also agree that something positive and concrete so that people can identify with has to be done. It has to be done with a sense of urgency, because the technology today is surpassing us. The world knows it. They know how much our dollar is really worth. And we're the only ones hanging on to this magic trick, wanting to believe. So bottom line is, we got to stop fixing something that was never broken, which is family, and that's what brought us here. So to go back to pre-industrialization times where we don't have to be farmers, but we have to launch the green-collar industry. Angeles, again, is the homeless capital of the world. OneBodyLA.com is day 42 deep at the South Central Farm. I've been there since December 2010 working on it. That was all I had to say. But, yeah, let's please work together. Sundays we're meeting, and, yeah, that was it.
Okay, thank you so much there, William. So there's a direct response to that from Michael Sheena. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, everybody. My response is to not the last guy, but the guy before him, about getting a constitutional amendment. First off, I want to say private funding in the elections, I mean, you have to admit, it's a cancer to the whole system. I mean, money amplifies voice, opinion, and manipulation basically more than any other person could. It makes the whole field unfair. Senator Bernie Sanders, I know not a lot of people have heard about him, but he has actually, he's in the process of proposing an amendment to overturn Citizens United and try to get money completely out of politics. And I think that that's a good step forward, and maybe we should look into that, look into advocating what he's doing. I also know there's actually, it's surprisingly, it's a Republican candidate. His name is Buddy Romer. Now, I mean, I know a lot of people in the movement aren't really conservative, and I don't think he really is too much, but basically, he hasn't really gotten any turns to debate or anything. You can look him up, but he wants to get money just completely out of the system. If you look him up online, I mean, I agree with most of the stuff that he says. I've been trying to help him out. So, I mean, if everybody could go look at him too, his name is Buddy Romer. I yield.
Thanks so much, Michael. Let's see here. Got Ian? Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to the Constitutional Convention angle and play a little bit of devil's advocate here. I mean, I don't think anybody on this call is going to dispute that we're royally screwed. The money's washing around this and twisting shit up to the nth degree. So something needs to be done. Overturning Citizens United alone isn't going to do it, because everything was mashed up and screwed to the nth degree long before Citizens United even came along. That's just an amplification of what previously existed. So to play devil's advocate for a second, in light of the fact that we have really a depoliticized society and people are going to be ever increasingly looking to their own needs, should the convention get called, it's going to open up Pandora's box potentially, and all that money, because the existing context is going to weigh in on that convention process, I was just wondering what people think about that reality. We get the convention, the money's still there, all these interests come in, and everything's fair game, and state legislatures are going to be ratifying it. Granted, it's a high threshold, 38, so 13 can keep things out of the Constitution. I just wanted to throw that out there, play devil's advocate, and see what people thought.
Okay, thanks so much, Ian. Next, we've got Alva. Go ahead, Alva.
With regards to the money out of politics, I wanted to have a direct response that my thoughts of that even for a while now, that I think we should abolish Congress and replace them with a General Assembly every state, and that the General Assembly will be a transitional body until we get all the needed protection of laws that will protect the people again from being screwed and being politicians corrupted. Until then, I think we should abolish the Congress, replace it with the General Assembly as a transitional body, and initiate the laws, and then put back our Congress. I think that's how we can get money out of politics. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Alva. And I do want to remind people that I'm doing my best to try and keep the direct responses in order, but if you could try to respond to what people are saying in addition to your own thoughts so that we can build something collectively here, that would be great as well, you know, to really work on things together. So there's one other direct response, and then we'll continue with the stack, and that's William, go ahead very quickly.
Yeah, thank you very much. To get the money out of politics is a great objective. To eliminate the Electoral College is a wonderful objective too as well. I don't discredit either of them, but we have to lay a foundation. You cannot build a house without a foundation. I've been banging my head against the wall since December 2010, banging my head against the wall since Occupy LA and Occupy Wall Street, and I will be banging my head against the wall tomorrow, and until we reopen and secure this farm for the 1 in 3 foster youth that become homeless. If you want to fix your economy, you put the homeless in homes. You secure the youth. And it's that simple. If we want to rectify our election system, we start within a family, the family into the economy into the nation. And this is a global movement, and we need to start treating it like one with a sense of urgency. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, William. And I do realize that I'm trying to jump and make sure that as many different voices are being heard as possible. I realize I'm not doing the best job of it, but I'll just keep trying my best. Go ahead, Ashley. You're next.
Okay. Yeah, I had tried to switch earlier, but since I'm here, when talking about getting the money out of politics, the idea of getting out of the campaign, you know, seems like the first place to start. But for me, the concern is if you look at the recent debate with the SOPA bill, you know, who are the groups behind it? Where do these politicians go to retire? And Chris Dodd went to the MPAA. So it's like, and same thing with Newt Gingrich. The more, you know, they earn these contacts, the more they're worth after they leave. I yield, and that's kind of my concern.
Thanks so much, Ashley. Lauren Steiner, you're next. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the getting money out of politics thing, because I just organized a meeting with Dylan Radigan, whose organization is called United. Got some big money behind him with Anjali Kronheim from Common Cause, who's part of a 70-group coalition with Public Citizen and People for the American Way and other liberal groups trying to get money out of politics. Cenk Ugar, who's founded an organization called Wolfpack, also trying to get money out of politics. It was a really fortunate, I felt really privileged to be able to be among these people, because they've all been working really long and hard on this. And I came to it, I organized this because I had the same agenda item that I had in the breakout group on a general call a couple of weeks ago, which is, shouldn't we all organize around one constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, because right now there's about 10 of them in the House and the Senate. And what sort of came out of that was, you know, like Dylan had a term, he called it modern insurgency, and it was just basically a lot of people pursuing the same thing from different angles. And he said, you know, none of these amendments are probably going to make it, but the fact that all the different people are pushing for it independently will cause a big groundswell. Move to Amend was also there, and Mary Beth Fielder, who was responsible for getting the resolution to overturn Citizens United out of the L.A. City Council, was basically saying their philosophy is to try for Congress to get one of these amendments passed and give them a year, at the same time building a 50-state apparatus where the cities and all the states work to have these resolutions. And then if Congress can't do anything in a year, then go for the Constitutional Convention. But one thing that was talked about with the Constitutional Convention, to reiterate what two people ago said, which is that it is going to open it up to all sorts of other amendments that we in the Occupy movement may not be too happy about, such as a balanced budget amendment or a right to life amendment or any of these kind of things. And right now the state legislatures are pretty much controlled by the Republicans that got in 2010. So it may be opening up a can of worms that we want to start, that we don't want to open. And also in response to another caller who said removing private funds from campaigns is a nonpartisan issue, it was pointed out that that is absolutely a no-go for the Republicans. They don't want public financing of campaigns. They never have. They never will, because they don't believe that.
Okay, Lauren. Yeah.
Right. Well, I just wanted to, you know, there's a bunch of direct responses in my comments.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do appreciate that. I'm just trying to keep things moving as much as possible. Thank you so much for your comments. The next person this up was Aaron Bronstein. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hi. Yeah, thanks, Lauren. I think you actually covered a lot of the points I wanted to make. So I'll just rehash very quickly. First of all, the Constitutional Convention process, it is fairly conservative in that 38 states have to ratify what comes out of it. But I also think that we shouldn't necessarily be afraid of it. I mean, this is kind of what Occupy is built for. It's changing a national conversation, and we should be looking forward to the opportunity for that national conversation to have a real imprint on the DNA of the nation. The second thing I want to say is just put in a plug. So last week for our Occupy the Courts event, we had Chris Hedges, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and Larry Lessig, who's a professor at Harvard who's been pushing for a convention to overturn corporate personhood. We had them come to town for our event to speak at our rally, and rather than just having them speak for 4 minutes each, we put them in conversation with each other for 40 minutes and just sat them in front of a camera and let them go. And they said some really powerful, really useful things about this very issue. So if you go to OccupyTVNY.org, OccupyTVNY.org, you can catch that whole conversation and see in particular what Professor Lessig has to say about a constitutional convention and its use in sort of as a point of leverage for getting Congress to act in the way that we want it to. That's it. I yield.
Thank you so much, Aaron. So the next person that we've got here, we've got a direct response to that from Travis. Go ahead, Travis.
Well, that was a while ago. Basically, I was just going to say what he just said. So.
All right. Again, I'm trying to work all this out. Wasn't expecting to facilitate this, but just flying by the seat of my pants here. So. The next person that we got up here is Giovanni. Giovanni, go ahead.
Sorry to jump on the stack again. I just wanted to clarify what the decolonize movement is about. It's actually a way to bring indigenous struggle into the movement, and I suggest for anyone who is unfamiliar with the history of the American Indian movement to look into it, as well as Wounded Knee. And the decolonized movement isn't something that is radical or trying to take on agenda, but simply trying to include the needs of indigenous people that have been ignored for a very long time. So mine was just a point of clarification around the decolonized movement. Thank you. I yield.
Okay. We have one number two and one number three, and an agreement or disagreement with that. William, you still have a number 4 up. Would you tell us what that's about? Go ahead. And please use 2 names in the future, William, because for all of your benefit, when we have a Steve or a Bob or a William, and there are 20 Williams on the call, nobody knows which one it is. So go ahead, William.
Sure, not a problem. I do believe I'm the only William on this line. William Yanez with OneBodyLA.com and OccupyLA. Yeah, Gio, I couldn't agree more, man. I couldn't have said it better myself. It's all about accessibility to everyone, not just God bless America, but God bless our world and our community. I'm running short on time here, and I really wish I could talk a little bit more, but it just seems like we keep running over the same political rhetoric, and we're talking with this like politicians, basically, with this vernacular, because we're not addressing the tough questions, the real issues, like Noam was. So I'm sorry to talk so sharply, but we're going to have to move on and address the real issues, like the 18-year-old standing next to me and why he's homeless, and my other friends who are coming asking me for help, and there's no room at shelters. The answer is family. It's like Gio said, it's not radical. This is essential. One body laid out.
Okay, William, thank you. You made that point about 4 minutes ago. We have another number 4 now with John DeHara. Go ahead, John. You have it.
Yeah, direct response to William. Yes, we are engaging directly, and there are people talking about a convention. That's a good thing. The other direct response that I had earlier is this can of worms idea, or that the dynamic that currently exists will bear on a convention and it might be a big mess for us. When you look at this issue and the subject very closely, what you realize is the can of worms is the 1%. For them, that's what a convention is. The 1% has been actively trying to prevent a convention on the authority of our Constitution for over 100 years. This is documented. The media has been trying to prevent a convention. But if we get enough people to say we want a convention, they will dance out of the way, and we will have a convention, and it will do what it's designed to do. So there is no can of worms.
Okay, John, thank you very much. Listen, people, I know it sounds nasty sometimes, but there are so many people that would like to speak. We are going to be firm about this 90-second rule. Public speaking is an art. Encapsulating your comments
are an
art.
Hey, I noticed you had a 5 up.
And so we're going to pass the mic.
Yeah.
John, you're on open mic there, John. Okay, the next one's going to be...
Okay.
John,
right now we're in the main break... I just took you in the breakout to see what the 5 is about, but right now there's a main room that most people are in, just looking at all the different issues. Yeah?
Okay, I'm sorry about that, folks. You know, everybody has to, when people learn how to use this console, they sometimes, it's a bit confusing for them. There's a thing called private breakout rooms, and when sometimes the TAs move people into that, you hear the overspeaking, and that's because they didn't go back on private mic. Okay, Lauren, I'm going to put you up again, and then we're living strictly with the 90-second rule. Go ahead.
No, I didn't have anything more to say.
Okay, thank you very much. Giovanni, how about you? Go ahead.
I'm okay. Thank you.
Okay. You know something, folks? I think one of the things that this has done is everybody comes up, or several do, and they speak very passionately about their issue, the homeless, or about their issue, getting money out of Congress, or their issue, Article 5. If you dig into these, if you go back to McCulloch versus Maryland, some of the earliest decisions in our court, you realize that in many, many ways, not just one or two, the Constitution's gone off track. And the interpretations of it have gone off track. The Supreme Court has, and of course the Congress, too. Its major issue is to keep its jobs. And if the corporate money machine does that, it does it. So try to be understanding of each of the different passionate groups and try not to be critical of the others as you go forward and say, my issue, Article 5, is the be-all, end-all issue. The others don't count. Or homelessness is the biggest issue in America. I just suggest that as we move on. Okay, we have a couple number fours. Summer, you're up. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, since there seems to be a lot of talk about the Constitutional Convention, maybe we can just all agree to just talk about that on Thursday, so that if there's other things that people want to talk about, like Noam talked about, we can just get back to the agenda of topics. That's one thing. And if you get caught in a breakout room that you don't want to be in, just push to number one and the panel key, and you'll get back into the main group. I yield.
Okay. Unfortunately, Summer, your mic is really bad, and a lot of people didn't hear you. But I think what you wanted to do was stick with the topic that Noam was discussing. We've actually opened this up a bit more into a broader discussion. There's no one left in the number one stack right now, and so there's no point in focusing on some of the notes. Travis, you have the mic. Go ahead.
I was just saying, as far as all of these different issues people have, they're more passionate about. As far as getting money out of politics, it encompasses all these other issues is the thing. So it's all global warming, the homeless and stuff like that. If we focus on all those things, we're just, I can't remember the Harvard professor, we're chopping at the evil branches instead of just going to the root of the problem. I think that that's what this movement should be about. It should be the first movement in history that goes to the root of the problem. And we can fix all the other problems later, but we just have to get to the root first, and then it will be so much easier to fix the homeless problems and all these other things. So just by focusing on the one, getting the money out of politics issue, you are inadvertently helping the homeless issue. See what I'm saying?
Okay. Thank you very much, Travis. I think a lot of people, about 64% in the last poll I saw, I think that's the biggest issue in the country. But there are others who don't necessarily agree. Okay, John, you've got 90 seconds on the clock. Go.
Okay. Having talked about a convention for a while, people get confused as if a convention is my issue. But I didn't write the Constitution, so it's not my issue. And everything is connected, whether we like it or not. And there is no other United States of America, there is no other Constitution, and it's got a convention clause. So as far as wanting to change the subject, Occupy Wall Street should be advocating for an Article 5 convention objectively. That will be what the previous caller just said. It will be us actually going to the root of the problem. That's what a convention is. I yield.
Okay, thank you very much. We're now going to go back on stack. Alva, you have the mic. Go ahead.
We're talking about how to get money out of politics. This is a little bit, rare to suggest, but I don't know exactly how. But how about taking the power from money in itself? I think we, the people, gave the money so much power that it make people corruptible. And how about if we put some limits to the money in itself? I don't know how to do that, but I thought I'll just throw it out there. I yield. I am from Occupy New Hampshire, by the way.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alba. All right. Next, we have Albert A. Arroyo. Go ahead, Albert.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that money in and of itself is neutral. That it's not evil, and it's not good. It's just neutral. It's a means to an end. And this idea that you're going to take it out of politics and then everything is going to be fine is completely fallacious. What we need are the laws to be enforced. We're trying to raise like $1 billion this year. So here they are saying that we should take money out of politics, and they're trying to raise $1 billion. It's absurd to think that you're going to take money out of politics. And that's not really, I don't think, what we're all about. We are about economic justice and social justice for all of us. And money is just immaterial. Over.
Okay, thank you very much, Albert. Folks, in your tone, try to be gentle to all the rest of us. I think a lot of people realize that it's a very, very challenging objective to get money out of politics. But if the wording was done carefully enough, it could be done. The real problem is that, well, I think I'm going to brace off what Travis said. Travis was suggesting that both parties, even the extremist Republicans right now, would like to see greater getting money out of politics. Well, that's a good reason to take advantage of the fruit that hangs right in front of you. So it's really a matter of getting general consensus and agreement, and that's what we try to do in all of these forums around the country, NGAs. Okay, Rice, you have the mic. Go ahead. Rice, you have the mic.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to make the point that maybe what we're thinking about is money is the problem, and a couple of callers talked about that earlier, is we have, unfortunately, a skewed idea of what money is. We think the stuff we put in our pocket is money. That's, in fact, currency. What gives that currency value is money, which is our offer to the market. And the stuff we use in our pocket is nothing more than tokens that we use to deal with the efficiency of transacting with, you know, masses of different people. And we see that happening all the time with the playing in the markets and so on, with what the value of the, quote, dollar is, what the currency is. And so when you think about currency as being something different than money, then you start to realize where the authority and where the power and where the responsibility is, and that's what the individuals, and I think that was one of the early comments, that if you take, quote, money, and I'm assuming when they talk about that, they're saying the currency, out of politics, it's probably not going to make that much difference. What will make difference is how much power we grant the money and the people that we put in there. And it's a value system, and I think that's the part that needs to get looked at, is the wrong set of values are being rewarded, and to try and change that is difficult because the power brokers that are in there right now have an enormous amount of force to keep it there. And I mean all kinds of force. We just saw the new regulation going in that they can detain anybody. They have all kinds of chilling your rights capabilities going on, and people just...
Okay, Raj, thank you very much, but I was serious about the 90 seconds. When you hear that bell, that means you got about 15 left. Amy, go ahead. You have the mic. Amy Horton. Amy, I can't hear you. You have the mic.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have an issue with the way that the mainstream is defining violence right now, and also the word anarchy, which are both closely related. Violence is defined by the World Health Organization as the intentional use of physical force or power, threatened or actual, against oneself, another person, or against a group or community.
Steve, you had a 5 up. Did you want to say something or do something here? Ian, can you hear me? All right.
Am I still on? So the mainstream media, I'm from Seattle, the mainstream media is portraying some of the individuals who are acting in some of these marches and presenting somebody waving a flag as if that was an act of violence worthy of getting pepper sprayed and being banged down to the ground. The other thing I wanted to say, which was important, is that I work in an anarchic group within the movement, and we're a highly functioning group that has no upper management, and this kind of group should be used as an example and brought to the community and used as a teaching tool in order to re-explain the meaning of the word anarchic.
Okay,
that's
thank you
all.
Very much. Thank you. And Giovanni, you're up. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say that I think the Article 5 conversation is a great one to have, but I think in order to move forward on it, it'll really require real engagement. And I think the real engagement will come from, while you say that homelessness will be addressed through Article 5, at the same time, if we don't take these communities into perspective, then we're simply doing a disfavor to those communities by not getting them engaged and participating. And I forgot the rest. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Lauren, you have the mic now. Go ahead.
I'm going to take my 90 seconds to read something from Bowling Alone, which I think pertains to this. It was a book published in 2001 by Robert Putnam. Few people outside of, in a nutshell, he argued that civil society was breaking down as Americans became more disconnected from their families, neighbors, communities, and the republic itself. The organizations that gave life to democracy were fraying. Bowling became his driving metaphor. Years ago, he wrote, thousands of people belong to bowling leagues. Today, however, they're more likely to bowl alone. Television, two-career families, suburban sprawl, generational changes in values, these and other changes in American society have meant that fewer and fewer of us find that the League of Women Voters or the United Way or the Shriners or the Monthly Bridge Club or even a Sunday picnic with friends fits the way we have come to live. Our growing social capital deficit threatens educational performance, safe neighborhoods, equitable tax collection, democratic responsiveness, everyday honesty, and even our health and happiness. So I really think, for me, the Occupy movement is a movement of values. I mean, it really comes down to it. Getting money out of politics is an objective, and all the other things that we're doing are tactics. But really what our movement about, if you were to put a mission statement to it, is values for social and economic justice. And this really has to start within our own communities, within our own selves. And I'm just taking off of what the other person said. I yield.
Okay, thank you, Lauren. You still had 15 seconds left. You know, that this discussion of changing values versus changing laws comes up in many, many calls. Changing values, because they're taught by parents from about 2 years old on, takes generations sometimes. And that's, I think, why some people try to reach toward the law. But both need change. There's no question about it. John Schwarzman, you need to have the mic. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for accepting my call. So I wanted to get back to something that was talked about a lot earlier, and that has to do with banks. And the reason why a lot of people's mortgages are not being funded by the banking institutions is because, fortunately or unfortunately, the interest rates are so low on a 30-year term loan. They're in the 4% range. Investors, banks, institutions aren't interested in getting a 4% return on their monies for 30 years with the risk of somebody perhaps not being able to make the payment. So until the administration or Congress or whoever might be the parties involved require banking institutions to put a certain percentage at least of their lending and their investing into home ownership, you're not going to see any change for a long time until interest rates rise. And in that case, and then a lot of people fall out of being able to afford what those highest interest rates require. I yield.
Well, John, let me get some clarification on that. What you're saying is that the federal government should just finance homes for people?
No, I'm not.
Go ahead and say that. Make your point.
What I'm saying is that until the federal government or the require banking institutions, particularly those that were bailed out, until they're required to make a percentage of their investment be required to finance home mortgages, you won't see any change in banking behavior, because there's no reason why an investor will take a 4% interest rate yield on his money for a 30-year period with that sort of risk. They'd rather make 11% for 6 months, which is what they've been doing.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. All right. Thank you, John. Rates are extraordinarily low. They've been, in the last 3 weeks, at the lowest they've been in history. And I think that having been in mortgage finance on Wall Street, I can say that John's right. If we didn't have these vehicles, like credit default obligations or collateral mortgage obligations, mortgage-backed securities, to transfer the mortgages out of the bank and off to the international capital markets, they would never make loans at rates like that, because so little return for the risk they take over 30 years on you, a homeowner, is extraordinary. All right, we're going to take a direct response from Steve. Steve, you have the mic.
Hello?
Steve? Yep.
Hi, do I have the mic?
Steve, go ahead.
Okay, great. Thank you. What I want to state is that interest rates are historically low, and it's unnatural. We need to be at double these interest rates, more at 8%, and everyone's real estate really is worth half what they think it is. We're in the clouds.
Okay, thank you, Steve. I will say that, as many of you know who've studied monetary economics, the Fed used to, under Keynesian economics, manage within money bands, M1, M2, and M3, and they had like 1.5% to 2% ranges that they would manage the money supply in by stimulating the growth of money and the velocity, the turnover of money. And they do that with a federal, with a discount window, the Fed discount window. Right now that's at 0.75 basis points or 0.75% per year. That's the amount the bank pays to borrow money from the Federal Reserve, the central bank. At some times that rate was up as high as 12.5% in the 82 time frame, when the long bond, the 30-year treasury, was up around 18. Well, Alan Greenspan departed from the concept of managing the money supply. He just wanted to leave it open to the banking system to regulate themselves, and that's what caused tremendously reckless lending, only because special purpose vehicles could be formed offshore, and they could immediately make the loans, get the fees for those loans, and then stuff them to someone else, some SPV that had virtually nothing but a name as a trustee. And then they split those up in various mortgage securities and sold them to pension funds in Finland, China, and every place else with a AAA rate on a lot of it. It was greed run amok, and a government that chose not to regulate. Both Congress had deregulated through the last two decades, and we had a Fed that decided to let Wall Street go wild. So it was a problem, and rates right now are probably below where anyone would lend money prudently to someone else for 30 years. Okay, John D. Herrera, you have the mic. Go ahead.
Steve, I don't know if anyone has ever told you, but your voice, you sound like you should be in Cape Canaveral or at Houston Mission Control or something. You got a great coordinator's voice. What Lauren said earlier, what you read out of the book, and what Noam Chomsky said during his talk, that we have this breakdown society, people are isolated, all these things that we're horrified at. We're looking, how can we change this? And, of course, I can't stress it enough, because it's the objective truth. If we have a convention today, it starts a three-part national discussion that reengages all of us again. And the 1%, they don't want to get crushed like a bug, so they're just going to dance out of the way, just like they dance right now to keep politics as usual going. So, I think we have the option of maybe making a movie, some kind of popular documentary that shows Americans what a convention is, that really creates that critical mass and tipping point of people desiring a convention. So those are some of the ideas on the table, and I appreciate you guys putting up with me being, I guess, indignant. You know, I think we all are. You know, socially things are just, I don't like the way the world is that I'm living in, and I recognize the convention is a way to change that, and I hope that folks can think about it. I think we can get it this year. And with that, I say thank you very much, and I yield.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, it'll be, incidentally, to that point, a constitutional convention, whether it's to push one amendment or several, many people think that our Constitution has been banded together by paper clips and wires for so long, it definitely needs that. On the other hand, the degree of cohesion, even within one of your GA movement, is so tough to get in agreement for something like that, that it hasn't caught on with enough. I know, John, you're passionate enough about it. Many people feel that if we were to call for a constitutional convention, we meaning the American people, not the movement, that we would find that many of the good things about the Constitution might get thrown out. On the other hand, I don't think we can necessarily cower from it at some point. Summer, you're up next. Go ahead. You have the mic.
I have a direct response to the convention idea, and John and I, a few other people, I talked about this on a call before, about having like a pre-convention, kind of like putting it out into our local General Assembly, say, hey, if we were to have a convention, a national convention, let's get together, start our conversations locally as to what that Constitution to, or the constitutional amendments to be, and then we go, and if we can all sort of agree at our local local occupies, okay, then now let's gather in a notion in a national either location, physical or maybe even online, and have then the next step of like a pre-convention. Okay, this is what we would all agree on if we were to have a national convention, and kind of take it maybe into this three-step process so that we see where we would go with this convention before we actually call for one. I yield.
Okay. Are there comments about whether or not we should have try within, say, the Occupy movement to begin the process of drum beating for a national convention of some sort or for an occupation convention? Please hit number 4 if you would like to discuss that. Alvy, go ahead on a 4.
Is it me, Alva?
Yeah, actually, yes. Go ahead, Alva.
Yeah, I kind of agree to that. That I think we should make it specifically a national convention, or maybe we should geared towards like an. Bear with me because English is not my first language; it's only the 4th. So. I think we, the Occupy movement nationally should meet together on a national level and discuss and dissect what our country or the chaos is going on this right now to identify where were they at, which one is the most in crisis right now. Something to the tune. We don't have to talk about, like, specifically a constitutional convention, which it could be, we can talk about it. But, again, why don't we just gather all together nationally, all the GAs all together, put together, and then we'll discuss and dissect what is really going on. Thank you.
Okay. You know, Alva's point about having a get-together is tough. First of all, a geographic get-together can be exclusionary. It ends up that those that can afford it go, can't, won't. In this day of telecommunications, corporations and governments speak globally by the moment. In conference calls, be they for audio. And in another 50 years, we'll be speaking through the cosmos that way. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, but I think what many have been waiting for is enough coalescence of that point of view that there needs to be a national convention. It would be easy to overlay a telecommunications set on it. So perhaps that discussion and that emphasis will come up again and again on calls and in meetings to begin to call for. John Schwartzman, you have the mic. Go ahead and a direct response to, I believe, Summer and Ella.
Yes, I'm from Occupy Philadelphia, and I have heard and maybe have read also that there is a movement to have a national convention in Philadelphia on July 4th of this year. I yield.
John, you're right. There is. It's one of the many, many direct events or direct actions that are taking place. And once again, the toughest thing they can do is get the word out. Here at InterOccupy, we've formed a contact list of occupants across the country. They're putting it in. It hasn't been published yet because they're trying to purify the data. And they're dealing with the privacy concerns about, they don't want it out there for everybody. But the idea is to try and permit the word to get out to every occupation, not just here in the United States, but in Canada too, and the globe, in order to suggest things and see what the feedback really is. But it's tough to even get occupations to say, okay, here's the name of our contact, and we're willing to be part of a global network of occupations to receive information and process it. Okay, next we're going to go to another direct response from John D. Herrera again. John, you have the mic.
I just, you know, yes, the 99% declaration is having a 4th of July convention, but, and you know, I'm going to try and do what I can to have that group talk about an Article 5 convention, but we are inter-occupy, right? And so if inter-occupy held a convention and came to the consensus, hopefully, we can only try, that all occupies should begin calling for an Article 5 convention, that in and of itself could cause the pressure to for Congress to issue the call. So I would, in response to that, I would say yes, they're having one July 4th. There have been other conferences like that that have been marginalized by the media and ignored, and that's what I expect might happen with that. But if I was going to go with a convention, I would go with the Inter-Occupy Convention because that's the one that's directly hooked up to all the conventions. And it could be exciting for the various occupies to elect delegates to that convention. So I yield.
Okay. I'm going to say that, John, you feel that Inter-Occupy is a place to do this because you frequent the Inter-Occupy calls. But let me assure you there are many, many occupations across the country that haven't attended one call and don't even know we exist. So we're not necessarily the be-all, end-all entity either. Lauren, you've got a direct response. You have the mic. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to remind people or let people know who don't know about it that there is a call tonight for the planning of the national gathering. It's going to be at 9 p.m. Eastern time, so anyone that's interested in that can register for that call. And also to let you know that, Steve, one thing that I mentioned in the call last week on that national gathering is that there's an organization called America Speaks that did some town hall meetings nationwide over the budget issue, and they met in selective cities, and they were able to communicate with each other. And because of the Internet, because of Skype, because of the technology that we have that you mentioned, there is a way for people that cannot, you know, get to the national gathering to either go to a regional gathering or communicate over their home. So I think it's an excellent idea, and I think it can be done so that it is the most participatory way possible. I yield.
And, Lauren, when you say it, are you meaning Inter-Occupy should host it or someone else should?
No, Inter-Occupy is not. This national call, this is going to be the second call. I think it's sponsored by Occupy Philly. And just get on the call tonight if you want to see what they're thinking of. But it's not hosted by Inter-Occupy. They're just using the Inter-Occupy system to have the calls to plan the gathering.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, the next speaker speaking, I'll get that link and put it on your participant dashboards in case others of you would like to sign up for that. I appreciate that, Lauren. Okay, next we've got a on the stack. Summer, you have the mic. Go ahead. Summer? All right,
oh,
I think Summer's
oh.
off. Steve, we're going to pass.
Nope,
go
I'm
ahead,
here.
Summer, you have the mic.
All okay, right. Sorry about that. I really feel at the bottom of the heart, of my heart and the heart of my being, someone else had spoke about this, that this movement really is about personal responsibilities. If we're the ones spending money, we've got our money in the banks, we're buying stuff from the Gap, we're buying stuff from McDonald's, we're empowering the very corporations we seek to disempower with our financial vote every second of every day, the TV that we're watching, the media that we're listening to. Anytime we see or hear or are in a situation that is not in alignment with what we believe is the ultimate purpose of being a human being, of being love, of being positive, we need to change that channel.
I think pointing the finger, telling everyone else to change, is sort of misdirecting the focus, because really, if we stop putting our money in these places that we don't want to have power, they will cease to have power. So it really does take all of us really looking at that and changing that. I yield. And also write down to the thoughts we're thinking and the words we're saying. It's really that subtle. It's really that beautiful. I yield.
Okay, thank you, Summer. I think all of us agree that half the time we can look in the mirror and see some of the problems going on. Giovanni, you have a direct response. Go ahead. You have the mic.
Yeah, I'll make it real short. Hello? Hello, hello? Can you hear me?
You got it, buddy. Go for it.
Oh, okay.
Yep,
Thank you. Just in response to what Summer was saying, while I agree with some of what you said, I do disagree sometimes with anti-consumerist politics, meaning that by not consuming, we're having an effect on the change, when really there's systematic violence going on all the time against us. And I think one thing is important is empowering workers and taking it to the point of production, like we saw, you know, on the general call out for a general strike against EKG, I guess, the grain. I'm not really sure, but the people who have direct connections to Goldman Sachs. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I know that that will open up a lively conversation. Probably not suitable for this time, but yeah, thank you. I yield.
Okay, thank you very much, Giovanni. Next on stack, we got Steve. Steve, you have the mic.
Thank you. I appreciate the time. I want to go over two issues really quickly. One is unifying messages. During the recent arson in Los Angeles, the LA fire people unified under one hashtag, and it made a difference. We run Occupy hashtags and the .org. Please contact us, or we'd happily give this Twitter, Facebook, as well as a domain to somebody to run with. We also run Occupy Parents, Occupy Teachers, and Occupy Alumni. We are looking for people to help with this. Number two, rewards programs. We don't have proper rewards programs for regular people. We have it if you own American Express, and it's a reward system where if you have money, you get rewarded. However, we need Occupy Bucks tomorrow. We need to create our own currency between each other, and if we have to associate it, like what Summer said, maybe the Gap, maybe Starbucks, maybe Howard Schultz is willing to pitch in a dollar for an Occupy Buck, and then you're giving to a good cause, and we could start our own type of fundraising and our own currency. We need to get off the currency. We know it's been hyperinflated. A black market is going to form. It's already started. So let's create our own currency that has ethics. I yield the time.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Next in stack, we have, again, John D. Well, John, you've got the mic. John DeHart. Go ahead.
Yeah, it must have been a previous one. You'll...
Okay, thank you very much. Folks, there's nobody else on stack. We have some twinkly fingers and one disagreement by Michael Sheenan. Michael, would you like to express what your disagreement with the last speaker was? You have the mic. Go ahead. Michael Sheenan. Okay. Michael must be away from his computer. All right, folks, the stack's empty. I appreciate it. If anybody else has a comment, I've let this run on because I think, God, there's a lot of passion. I'm putting up right now the link for this meeting tonight. It's called the National Work Group, and you're welcome to attend. It's beneficial to everybody, and I think that maybe it will bring us to some focus. InterOccupy, to this point, to answer specifically a question about this, has tried to not to be the entity that pushes single issues. We've tried to be nothing but the string between two orange juice cans because we felt that once we got into issues, we'd no longer have the unbiased position or the perception of unbiasedness necessary. We want to be the communications. We want other entities and movements, whether they're national affiliations or individual general assemblies, to get the ball rolling and use the system to sell it. So I've just put up a link called National Work Group. And you're welcome to join that tonight. I think it would make it a richer call if you did. And I think you'll get a chance to see just how much is trying to go on related to bringing national energy together and concentrating the energy of general assemblies, occupations, and work groups into getting forceful change in an organized fashion. If we try to do everything at once, we will definitely fail. If we prioritize the campaigns after careful discussion of the strategy to do it and pick the ones that are most achievable first and then the next achievable and then the next, we'll probably have a much greater chance of success. Okay, the link is now up. Hope to see you all in another call. There's still no further ones, but I do have one comment from Summer, who's one of our TAs, and she knows what a five means, so she has a point of order. Summer, you have the mic.
Yes, I was actually wondering if Occupy will let the call that was recorded with Noam Chomsky, if they will send that out to everybody who is on this call, for everyone. I yield.
You bet. I posted that on the link about 30 minutes ago, saying that we're going to post the link for the recording and send it to everyone so they can play it again at their leisure and give it to others. Is that good enough?
Excellent. That's awesome. I love you, Stephen. Okay. I love InterOccupied.
I wish I could collect on that. All right. Does anybody have any closeout? We have about 9 or 10 people here. Why don't you? Well, we got one up, so we'll start that, and then anyone else that wants to make a closeout of any sort, please go ahead and hit the number one key. Eden, you have the mic. Go ahead. Eden? Well, I think we're missing Eden. He fell off the call just as I was handing him the mic. John, did you have another thing to say in closeout, John?
Yeah, Steve, I'm just here on my phone, and I don't have a dashboard or anything in front of me. Was there a link or something? I've had problems going to the dashboard before, but if I can, I would like to call the national call, but I just don't have the link. I don't see it or anything.
Yeah, the link, where the calendar is on InterOccupy website, and it'll be there, so grab it when you do get to a computer.
Very good.
And we will go ahead and send out a recording to this call to everyone who was on the call. Okay, no more number ones in the stack, no more closeouts. Thank you all very much for attending, and we are going to have, or the people that sponsored Noam are going to have further calls. We have heard a lot of feedback from many of you that what people want, since we've had so many calls with general announcements and everybody's gotten up and made their point again and again and again, more people are saying, let's get concentrated focus calls by a primary speaker like a Noam Chomsky on a primary issue and let the people that want to coalesce around that issue come together, much as some did today, and see if that can help the education process. And we're going to try to start doing that. Hopefully it'll be successful. Summer, I'm going to let you one more time. You've got a one up there, and then we'll go ahead and close out the call. Go ahead, Summer.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to invite everybody over to miccheck.us. Come say hello to me. I'm Occupy Hope over there. I'd love to continue the dialogue. And we've got online discussions for chat discussions. Everyone
okay,
can
right.
like break out. So that's what I wanted to offer everyone, the opportunity. And you can have your own discussion there, too, of course. Just let us know what you want to talk about. That's it.
Great, friend.
Are you? Hey.